healthcare reform goes to court and what it might mean for investors and insurers. From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Monday, March 26th.
Coming up, Bernanke talks unemployment.
And Spanish job seekers may just need to say a few Hail Marys.
You'll hear all about it on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama's health care reform is having its day in court. For the next 3 days, the Supreme Court will hear arguments about several aspects of the overhaul.
26 states are challenging the law, parts of which are already in place. We want to know if and how the arguments could affect investors. So we turn to Julia Coronado, as we do every Monday. She's chief economist for BNP Paribas. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
So are investors paying attention to these arguments right now?
I have to say not really. They're much more focused on Chairman Bernanke's comments this morning, and they liked what they heard there.
Now, we're expecting the Supreme Court to make a decision on health care reform in June. How could that change investors' minds?
Well, I think that the healthcare law is really much more of a medium-term issue in terms of how it affects cost structures for companies. And even if we got, regardless of what the decision is, it's not likely to eliminate all uncertainty for businesses. If it gets struck down, then the question will be what will replace it. And again, the real issue is how will it affect hiring costs and therefore employment as well.
So what sort of thing are businesses, when this decision does come from the Supreme Court, what sort of things are they going to be watching for and thinking about for their bottom lines?
Well, again, healthcare has been a rising cost for employers. Employers that provide employee healthcare have seen these costs just skyrocket, and that's something that they don't like because it doesn't have to do with what they do, with the widgets they make or the services they produce. So it's a nuisance in many senses. And of course, what this does is really expand the reach of that employer-provided system by forcing employers, even who aren't involved in providing such benefits, to get involved and just making that an ever larger part of business.
Julia Coronado is chief economist for BNP Paribas. Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
As Julia just mentioned, business owners are paying close attention to the future of the health care reform law. Some argue it'll mean fewer jobs. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The new law requires employers to offer health insurance or pay a fee. It also raises Medicare payroll taxes. The National Federation of Independent Business is challenging the mandates and taxes. The NFIB says the Affordable Care Act is an overreach of government power that makes it more expensive for smaller businesses to create jobs. But MIT economics professor John Gruber says the new law offers businesses more predictable insurance premiums.
Today, small businesses can see their premiums go up and down by huge amounts year to year simply because an employee gets slightly older or gets slightly sicker. That will end under the Affordable Care Act because they'll be in one larger pool that's not rated depending on employees' health.
Besides, Gruber says, businesses with fewer than 50 employees are exempt from new taxes and mandates. After 3 days of arguments before the Supreme Court, justices will weigh in June. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
One industry watching the debate closely is, of course, the health insurance industry. J.B. Silvers joins me now to talk about this. He is a professor of health finance at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. J.B., good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what the insurance industry's stance on health care reform has been so far.
Well, they had a grand bargain that they would stop doing bad things if they could have enough new enrollees to spread out the risk.
That would be with the mandated insurance.
Yes, they were actually supportive of the bill. But it was contingent upon having enough new people come in. So they stopped doing pre-existing conditions and canceling policies and things of that sort to limit the risk if they had a broad pool. So part of the trouble is that if the pool goes away, that is, if the mandate goes away, They have petitioned the court to get rid of those things that are very popular.
So what is the insurance industry hoping for when it comes to this Supreme Court decision?
Well, I'm sure you'd find different people with different opinions, but I think by and large, at the industry level, they think this is a good deal. It broadens the market out if the plan stays. They get 24 million new customers. People are happier with insurance. They like what's going on. They're scared, though, and they're particularly scared that if they lose the mandate, then they'll have to bear a whole lot more risk they hadn't planned on. And that could really destroy the business, cause major troubles for them.
So it's either an all or nothing kind of proposition from their point of view.
Well, it may be the worst of all worlds, and this is what they're worried about. The mandate goes, but the requirements stay. And then people could sign up for insurance when they get sick. Then they couldn't get rid of bad risks if they showed up. The things they've tried to do to hedge their risk, they'd still have to do that. They'd still have to accept people when they showed up, but they wouldn't have any assurance that they'd be getting an even distribution of people across different health status. It's really a dangerous time for them right now. If the mandate goes, the health insurance business is in big trouble.
J.B. Silvers is a professor of health finance at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. J.B., thank you.
Thank you.
As we heard earlier, Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke spoke today. He said unemployment rate has been declining faster than expected, but he said the job market still has a long way to go.
Discussions of the labor market at this juncture necessarily have a glass half empty, glass half full kind of tone. Recent improvements are encouraging, but as I've noted, in an absolute sense, the job market is still far from normal by many measures.
Bernanke said the U.S. economy needs to grow faster to get everybody working again. Investors think that could mean more stimulus.
So, Adrian, I have to ask you, are you a gadget person? Do you have
I like gadgets, but I'm not an early adopter.
Okay, well, me neither. Well, the Journal of Management and Marketing Research did a study which looked at which technological gadgets U.S. households adopted the fastest. Everything from cell phones to VCRs to personal computers. And it ranked them by the number of households that were using them 7 years after they hit store shelves.
That's so, interesting. So how far along these products were 7 years after they were introduced?
Yeah, so past the early adopter phase.
Okay.
I think 7 years is probably about when I start buying things. So, Adrian, can you guess which came in at number one in the last 50 years?
The iPad.
Actually, it's the boombox. The cassette, the ones with the cassette player.
Brilliant.
Yes. More than 60% of households had one 7 years in. For cell phones, only 10% of households had them. And personal computers, it was less than 5%.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
A big for-profit education group is set to announce second quarter earnings today. Apollo Group owns the huge online University of Phoenix. Its earnings are expected to be down, and its stock has already been downgraded. What's the deal? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
People who follow Apollo's stock are lowering their expectations a lot. Citigroup analyst James Sanford cut his estimate of earnings per share for fiscal 2013 by 18%. Why? For-profit colleges are facing tough competition from traditional brick-and-mortar universities, which are setting up their own online long-distance degree programs.
People are choosing the branded traditional school versus the for-profit school. And obviously Apollo is the largest player, so they have probably the most to lose.
New federal rules are also putting pressure on the for-profit colleges. The rules are meant to keep the school's students from defaulting on their loans. Kevin Kinzer teaches education at the State University of New York at Albany. He studied the for-profit school's decline.
They were in these double-digit enrollment boosts, and we've certainly seen the end of that.
The Apollo Group stock is down 20% just since the end of February. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And now another story about the business of education. It's been 10 years since the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School opened a satellite campus in San Francisco. To mark the occasion, the business school has moved to a bigger facility. As Charlotte Bear reports, it's part of Wharton's plan to attract more MBA students from the Bay Area's tech industry.
Students like Michael Sinkula are exactly why the Wharton School set up a shiny new shop in San Francisco.
I have a company here in the Silicon Valley. And since I started the company, I wasn't willing to leave the company and go to an MBA school.
There are lots of Sinkulas out here with years of experience working in startups, but little idea how to take businesses to the next level, especially going public. Wharton is betting demand for its executive MBA program is big enough to supply a steady stream of students willing to pay nearly $175,000 for a degree. That includes tuition, fees, food, lodging, and lots of bells and whistles.
So you'll see here we have study rooms with the technology embedded. We've got Skype cameras, high-speed internet. The whole floor is wireless, so we all have iPads.
These guys are basically coming to where the money is.
That's Tim Beharin. He's a high-tech industry analyst in Silicon Valley.
Wharton operates as a business, not just a business school. So the idea of growing the campus back east is fine. But if you have an opportunity to tap into a demand for MBAs, you look for the region that has that greatest demand. And at the moment, it's probably here in Silicon Valley.
He says the Valley is full of sad stories about startups that failed because they didn't have the right management. So this time around, venture capitalists are looking for companies whose execs have MBAs. Bernadette Burt is COO of the school. She says expanding Wharton isn't just about making money. It's also about making connections.
You know, we have our students with us for 24 months, and then we have alumni for life. So now the number of alumni that we have coming from this region and from these kind of companies, it's immeasurable.
In other words, the bigger the network of Wharton grads in Silicon Valley, the cozier the school's relationship with some of the country's fastest growing companies and their very rich founders. For Marketplace, I'm Charlotte Baer in Silicon Valley.
Healthcare is not the only industry in court these days. AMR, the bankrupt parent of American Airlines, says it's going to court to void employee contracts if it can't get more concessions from labor unions. From KERA in Dallas, Bill Zeeble has more.
American Airlines says the clock is ticking. Since filing for bankruptcy in November, it's negotiated with employees, but without sufficient progress. The company says it's been flexible, but Greg Overman with the Allied Pilots Association says he would not use that word.
To the contrary, what we have seen is pretty much along the lines of take it or leave it.
Overman and other unions say they'll fight in court, but aerospace analyst Ray Neidel with the Maxim Group says history is not on the union's side. Other bankrupt airlines have requested and received a judge's okay to kill contracts.
If American is going to survive long term, they got to get the right cost structure.
American Airlines says it needs $1.25 billion worth of concessions. Industry expert Michael Boyd says the carrier may succeed in court, but then what?
The question is, can they come out as strong as they can be, or are they going to come out with an employee force that really isn't as motivated as it needs to be?
Boyd says unions are frustrated because they gave major concessions 9 years ago, the last time American Airlines was in financial trouble. In Dallas, I'm Bill Zeeble for Marketplace.
And now the global perspective on business and economics. Spain's unemployment rate is nearly 25%. And now one institution says it has plenty of vacancies and a pretty amazing boss. The Catholic Church has started a recruiting drive in Spain. From Madrid, the BBC's Tom Burridge reports.
With over 23% unemployment, there aren't many employers offering a job for life, not to mention eternal riches. Spiritual riches, that is. Spain's Catholic Church spent $9,000 making their latest recruitment video. Several priests talking to camera, selling the virtues of their job.
Yo no te prometo un gran sueldo. Te prometo un trabajo fijo.
Like many parts of Europe, Spain has become increasingly secular in recent years, and some parishes are experiencing a shortage of priests. Raquel Maya Bibareña from Cristianos Redes, a progressive Catholic movement in Spain, thinks attracting people to the priesthood may actually increase the burden on the already struggling Spanish state.
This is particularly funny about this video because they are offering a permanent job, but of course the salaries are coming from the state.
Crushing debt burden or not, unemployment is sky high in Spain. At the moment, it's nearly 50% for those under 25. And with numbers like that, the church is hoping that more people will be ready to answer the divine calling. In Madrid, I'm the BBC's Tom Burridge for Marketplace.
In today's Midday Extra, a quick snapshot of this past weekend at the box office. Lionsgate had a very good weekend. Its film, The Hunger Games, took in more than $150 million domestically, making it the third largest movie opening of all time, behind Harry Potter and The Dark Knight.
Not too surprising. Predictions set up The Hunger Games as a blockbuster, and it's one in a line of many. Stu Levine is the assistant managing editor at Variety. He says The Hunger Games, like the Twilight movies, definitely had a built-in following, fans of the books.
But it's the average moviegoer. Sometimes the people like to go to the movies 3 or 4 times a year. Those are the people you never can tell what movie they're going to see, and it seems like they all turned out for The Hunger Games.
The big turnout over the weekend could also mark a big turning point for Lionsgate, which you might know best as the maker of the horror film franchise Saw.
Lionsgate is one of those kind of what they call mini majors. They're not a major studio, but they're not, certainly not, you know, a little independent studio either. And they have really made their mark on the Saw franchise over the years and these kind of movies that are fairly inexpensive to make. And then, you know, they make a nice little profit even if it makes only 40 or 50 million at the box office. But with a film like Hunger Games, I mean, that's a franchise film that can go on, you know, that could be at least 4 or 5 spinoffs if they wanted to do that, you know, if they don't wear out their welcome with audiences. And, you know, the box office on a film could propel a studio like this for years and years and years. Obviously, you know, there's going to be DVD revenue, there's going to be streaming revenue, there's going to be ancillary, like, you know, games and that kind of stuff. So a studio can have a film like Hunger Games, you know, similar to what Warner Brothers did with Harry Potter and Summit with Twilight. If you get one of these kind of franchise films, you could kind of milk that for years and years to go.
But there's more to the story. It turns out the theater chain that had one of the most successful takes over the weekend wasn't in New York or L.A., but in Utah. According to the L.A. Times, the Megaplex theater chain in Utah, owned by the Larry H. Miller Group, made the screenings more of an event by, among other things, setting up a slightly safer teen death match, complete with sumo suits, laser guns, and inflatable swords. As a result, 4 of the top 6 grossing theaters for midnight screenings nationwide were Megaplex outlets, Lionsgate said Friday. Early on Friday, all of the screens in the chain, 92, were playing the movie. And despite the high price tag for the premiere party, over $30, the theaters were packed. Oh, and by the way, the winner of the fake Hunger Games at the theater won a backpack and lunchbox donated by the studio. So at least we know there's one person who didn't go hungry.
And finally, Stacey, to the Arab Shooting Championships in Kuwait.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, where a Kazakhstan shooter won a gold medal. But instead of playing the country's national anthem, the event organizers played the spoof anthem from the movie Borat instead. Can you imagine how that athlete must have felt?
Oh my gosh, what did they do?
Well, they apologized, they promised up and down the mistake was unintentional, and they played the correct national anthem afterward. I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.